Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I remember my mother's emotion as she played All Things Bright and Beautiful on the piano, the windows open to her sun-filled garden. I remember her sadness when she played the haunting minor chords of There is a Green Hill Far Away, a hymn she chose for my father's funeral. And of course her rapture when she heard the quivering voice of a boy soprano heralding Christmas with the first verse of Once in Royal David City. But I didn't know the writer who wrote those hymns was an Irish woman until my eye chanced upon the name of Cecil Frances Alexander in the Church of Ireland hymnal. And when I found out that she wrote her most famous hymns while living in Strabane, just a few miles from where my mother grew up in East Donegal, all that emotion began to make sense. Many Ulster hymn singers claim that the purple-headed mountain in All Things Bright and Beautiful is Errigal, and they are absolutely convinced that the city wall in There is a Green Hill Far Away is that of Derry City. Except many of them call it Londonderry, as did my own Donegal grandmother. A reading of Valerie Wallace's biography of the woman known colloquially as Fanny Alexander brings back a suppressed childhood memory of my grandmother's attempt, when my nationalist mother was out of earshot, to pass on to me her fierce pride in the apprentice boys who in 1688 shouted no surrender and shut the gates of Derry City against the Jacobite forces. Fanny Alexander was feted in loyalist circles like my grandmother's for her reputed support of the apprentice boys. She had turned away officers searching for an effigy of Robert Lundy, who was reckoned to have betrayed them to the Jacobites. To the inquiry, "Is the Lundy in the house?" she is reported to have answered, "Yes, several. My little girls play with dolls." My grandmother would have been a small child when Fanny Alexander died in 1895, by then semi-royalty in her corner of Ulster as the wife of the Bishop of Raphoe, who had entertained the then Prince and Princess of Wales in the Bishop's Palace, and as a writer admired by Twain and Tennyson. But Fanny was, in fact, born in Eccles Street in the heart of Dublin City. She moved to Red Cross, County Wicklow, at the age of seven, and then to Strabane in 1833, when her father became an agent to Lord Abercorn. Her smash hit bestseller, Hymns for Little Children, was written in Strabane and published in 1848, the same year that Fanny lost her first love, Archer Butler, to famine fever. It ran to 69 editions before the end of the century, containing as it does the hymns for which she is most famous among hundreds of thousands of Anglicans. The iconic Nine Lessons and Carols, first performed by King's College Cambridge on Christmas Eve 1918 to commemorate the First World War dead, and copied in Anglican churches and cathedrals all over the world every Christmas, leads with a boy soprano singing the first verse of Fanny's hymn for little children. "Once in Royal David City stood a lowly cattle shed, where a mother laid her baby in a manger for his bed. Mary was his mother mild, Jesus Christ her little child." Listening to the words, "I am a child again, safe and warm in bed, while outside the wild winter winds strip the trees bare." Fanny Alexander's ability to look at the world through the eyes of a frightened child and make it safe is her special power. I have searched through the biographies for the source of this power to little avail. Fanny did found a school for the deaf with her sister, but she is no Dickens, burning with indignation at the plight of misused children. Instead, she can come across as a sanctimonious Victorian. So much so that there is a verse missing from All Things Bright and Beautiful in our hymnals because of its rigid endorsement of class distinctions. "The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, God made them high and lowly and ordered their estate." There is one clue to the source of her special power, however. The death of her brother Carbery in infancy when Fanny was 13 and still living in Wicklow. Biographers tend to gloss over this, as infant mortality was, of course, high in the mid-19th century. Isn't it likely, however, that our Victorian ancestors grieved their children just as much as we do ours, but didn't feel they had the right to grieve as openly as we do, until writers like Charles Dickens broke the silence with tales of Tiny Tim and Little Nell? Sick and dying children stalk Fanny Alexander's hymns for little children. Her God is a father who, unlike her own parents, can keep her baby brother well. Her heaven is a place where little Carberry is safe. And surely she saw his face as she wrote the last words of Once in Royal David City. Then like stars his children crowned, all in white shall wait around.
Hánig long o Valparaiso, squealacteda hioel sacoon, cura anam domiguina, riocht na graina, tir na mua. Those are lines from a poem I learnt in school by Padraig de Brún. It's actually a loose translation of an Oliver St. John Gogarty poem. A ship from Valparaiso came, and in the bay her sails were furled. She brought the wonder of her name, and tidings from a sunnier world. And the sun's on my mind as we face into winter solstice in my adopted home of Skerries. Skerries Harbour, unusually for a harbour on the east coast of Ireland, faces west. The ancient maritime architects skewed it so as to embrace the shore as a bulwark against spiteful nor'easterlies. There's no protection against the predominant westerlies, but that's an offshore wind, benign, flattening the water the harder she blows. As the winter solstice approaches, the vista from Joe May's pub on the quayside is bleak on the face of it. The pleasure craft are long lifted out to their landlubbers' havens, save for one or two hardy annuals left to their own devices by their indolent skippers. The fishing fleet huddles against the quay wall, three abreast, each one jostling for the best berth to ride out their temporary redundancy, mandated by strict quota restrictions. For no longer is Skerries a real fishing village in the proper sense. The herring shoals are long gone, completely fished out decades ago. What remains are smaller, sturdier craft that plough the seabed for shellfish, which are miraculously still abundant. Razor clams for the French market and prawns for the local restaurants along the quayside. Dublin Bay prawns, a lucrative catch with no carbon footprint to speak of, and tasty too. The quayside is quieter now without the summer hordes of loud, exotic motorcycles and their leather-clad grizzlies, fashionistas with bobbed hairstyles and labradoodles, and young fellas at the end of the pier luring mackerel and the odd pollock. Now there is an eerie stillness broken only by the shrieks of herring gulls and the rhythms of the tides, sometimes lapping gently, other times crashing on the rocky north beach, depending on the whim of the winds. The swallows on the little terns from Rockabill Island you see in the summer, diving for sand eels, are now replaced by Brent geese, gliding in regal formation around the bay. The bar is cosy with a real coal fire glowing. A scattering of fisher folk perch on their respective berths, sharing observations a million miles away from the looming lights of the nearby city, in a dialogue laced with sea lore and the traces of an ancient Fingal idiom. As a blow-in, I am canny enough to remain on the sidelines here. The company is respectful, but I am likely to be shredded in absentia as soon as I quit the premises. Anyway, I have other fish to fry, such as the peregrinations of the sun through the seasons. Along the east coast, northabouts, it sets over Claverhead around the summer solstice. That's as far north as it travels at sunset. It begins its journey back to me via Termonfeckin and Drogheda at high summer, Bettystown and Laytown as the autumnal evenings draw in, followed by a long stretch to Balbriggan before reaching its final destination over the Hoar Rock at the northern outskirts of Skerries. And all this I witness from my perch on the window ledge inside Joe Mays. Not every evening, mind, for I am not a total inebriate. In any event, this golden orb that regulates our very existence wraps itself in the clouds most evenings. But when it dips westward in a clear sky, quiet falls on the pub for a few precious moments as it casts its golden glow. Wind force and direction, tidal state and strength, sunrise and sunset, these are the magical elements that have regulated our very existence since time began. I hope the gods are not losing patience with us. The Vikings who careered into this rocky place in the 9th century, guided by the northern star, knew more than we do about some things. Even the Neolithic folk at Newgrange, Fornox and Nowth over the county border have encrypted missives for us, if only we can comprehend them. The solstice lit up their lives at the very nadir of the year. But for me, it's the cockstep in early January and the setting sun over the Lady Stairs below Ardgillan Castle that's the harbinger of longer days to come and the restoration of Riocht na Gréine in our very own Tír na Mua.
At the start of November, I was in Dublin Airport in a cafe that was selling mince pies at the till and playing Christmas songs on loop. All the classics, you know, Elton John, Wizard, Mariah. I am partial to a bit of cheese, whether the food stuff or the metaphorical kind, but not at the start of November. What I deem appropriate in a Christmas countdown, you know, how much cheese and when to consume it, is informed by the job that I had when I was 16. We were coming up on the millennium. The Celtic Tiger was still warming up to a roar. And after school and at weekends, I worked in a small supermarket in Gort, South County Galway. There was a seasonal rhythm to supermarket work in the late 90s, but it was gradual and it was contained. Christmas in the supermarket began with the arrival in the franchise delivery of ingredients needed for Christmas baking. Jars of mincemeat and apricot jam, marzipan, royal icing, mixed peel, candied fruit, tubs of glacé cherries, almond essence. After that came the Christmas music. Head office sent only one CD per month, so you can imagine how many times I'd hear each song in a week. For December, on the hour, every hour, we'd have what I then regarded as the more unfortunate Christmas songs, Mistletoe and Wine, or Keeping the Dream Alive, which is a Christmas standard despite having nothing to do with Christmas, or David Essex's A Winter's Tale, in which he lamented his lover ditching him, leaving behind only footprints in the snow. I associated these songs with the peculiar delectables on the shelves, and so as the days rolled on, I came to love them, in secret, until now. It was a perfect, cheesy storm. The momentum of the Christmas countdown, the novelty of the foods, the over-identification with the schmaltzy lyrics. Look, I was 16. There was probably some boy or another I was thinking too much about. While David Essex crooned about whoever broke his heart, I stocked the shelves at last with the real fripperies, but fewer than we would come to expect in the age of breathy M&S ads that extolled all that was hand-rolled sumptuously enfolded or courvoisier drenched. Instead, there were tins of Danish butter cookies and USA biscuits, boxes of roses no one wanted to get the task of wrapping because they were infernally trapezoidal, Cuisine de France mince pies, selection boxes shaped like Christmas stockings, packages of Herbie stuffing, bottles of Sandman port and Harvey's Bristol cream, and Blue Nun, of course, for the very urbane. And the Christmas RTE guide? When the bumper issues came in, suggesting that we spend at least a week slothfully watching old classics in our pajamas, it was unequivocally Christmas. From then till Christmas Eve, there would be full trolleys at the till, harassed but cheerful customers, and managers in new jumpers actually deigning to pack bags. It felt meaningful, properly affecting to a kid just figuring out the tempo of adult life. At other times of the year, space wasn't made on the shelves for items that were scrumptious just for the sake of it. Managers hid in offices. There weren't sinfully early showings of classics on the telly. Hearing A Winter's Tale 8 times a day would have been much harder to stomach if you hadn't been promised a week off and your weight in biscuits. It said, retail staff detest Christmas music. And I imagine the craters above in the cafe in Dublin Airport listening to Stay Another Day in November would qualify. But this never happened with me. I worked up an appetite for what was syrupy, stacking shelves in a supermarket, and never got so full that I felt sick. For this is the advantage of keeping Christmas contained in December. And after we closed on Christmas Eve, and the boss brought us to the pub for a hot port and a pat on the back, I would join my mam for midnight mass, so full of toddies or sticky ballads that I was moved even by religion. 16. Hopped up on the glorious odysseys of the past couple of weeks, tears rolling down my face for what seemed to be no reason at all.
The nights are colder now. Maybe I should close the door.
My grandmother was born in Myvore, County Westmeath, in 1896. She was from a large family, 9 children, 4 boys and 5 girls, and they all lived well into old age, except for one of the boys who died in the big flu of 1918. Unusually for that time, all the girls, including Nana, were sent to boarding school in Forbann, County Offaly. After leaving school, Nana worked in Spicer's Bakery in Navan and then married and settled in Rosscrea, County Tipperary. She gave birth to 2 sons, one being my father. Nana lived till the ripe old age of 98 years. For the last 10 years or so of her life, she lived happily in a nursing home in North Dublin. Coming up to Christmas in 1984, I went to pay my usual visit to my then 88-year-old Nana in the nursing home. I was 23 years old and proudly had my own car. During our usual chit-chat, she said to me, "You know, Jim, I've never been to the airport." "You're not serious, Nan," I said. "I am," she said. "Sure, I don't even have a passport." So I told her I'd take her there and we could have our tea there. "And Jim," she said, "would they do pork chops, peas, chips and tea bread and butter?" "I'm sure they would," I said. So a couple of weeks later, myself and my Nana headed for our tea to Dublin Airport. The minute we got out of the car in the car park, she said to me, "What's that smell?" It was aviation fuel, something she'd never smelt before. We made our way into the airport and up the escalator to the restaurant, which was heaving with people. This was back in the day when there was only one terminal and one self-service restaurant on the first floor in the airport. "You go find a seat," I said to Nana, "and I'll queue up and bring down your tea." The queue was long, but finally I got to the top of it and I put in my Nana's order. Pork chops, peas, chips, tea, bread and butter for the two of us. I put it all onto a large tray and looked around the restaurant for my Nana. She was a very small, slight lady with short, fair hair. Eventually, in a far corner, I spotted the back of her head. I made my way through the masses of people up to where she was sitting. Suddenly, three or four large, burly men dressed in black appeared in front of me with their arms folded. "Where are you going?" I pointed in behind them to the corner where Nana was. I said, "I'm going into my Nana with her tea." They moved to one side. As I was heading towards my Nana, I realised that she was sitting on the outside bench of her table and there were two men sitting on the inside. She'd obviously noticed a gap and had taken the spare seat. When I was about 2 or 3 yards away, I realised in shock and amazement that Nana was sitting beside George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley from Wham. One of the biggest pop bands in the world at the time, they just played two nights in the RDS. At that stage, I was hoping that the ground would open up and swallow me, but I had to continue. When I got to the table, I said to my Nana in a quiet voice, "Come on, Nana, we'll find another seat." Immediately, George Michael said, "No, sit down. This is the most interesting lady we've ever spoken to." So I sat down and the table of four was complete, with me, Nana, George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley. We proceeded to have our tea, this unlikely foursome. The two pop stars were warm and friendly, and the four of us chatted away naturally. I remember that they were fascinated with the fact that my Nana had been born in the 1800s, the last century. They appeared to be really interested in what she had to say. Then everything went quiet. My Nana leaned forward to me and she said in quite a loud voice, "Jim, these boys have earrings." Once again, I was hoping for a hole in the ground to open up. But the two pop stars laughed and laughed and were genuinely enthralled with my Nana. After we all finished our tea, maybe half an hour later, we said our farewells and left. Every time I hear Wham's Last Christmas on the radio, I think of that December day back in 1984 when my Nana visited Dublin Airport for the first time and had her tea of pork chops, peas, chips, tea, bread and butter in the company of two absolute gentlemen, Andrew Ridgeley and the late George Michael.
Now it is Chanukah, and I lit a candle to memory. The soft flicker of a single flame, the first of 8 candles to be lit throughout the days of this holiday, lights up a faint nostalgia in me for the old copper menorah in my childhood home, the traditional candelabra standing guard in the darkened window. It had been smuggled from hiding place to hiding place during World War II, getting battered and dented along the way. But there it was, years later, ready to shine on our childish faces. I linger in that nostalgia for the duration of the burning of this one candle. The next 2 candles could hold a promise of presents for all, of songs to be sung, and that the flaming light might last. According to the story, the lights kept burning for 8 days, even though there was only enough oil for one. 8 candles are lit in total to celebrate a miracle and in memory of people being liberated from an oppressor to live in freedom. The winter cold encloses our days in Dublin, where we stay inside and read off screens or pages to learn, or even wish sometimes we could unlearn what others tell us about the world. We watch small miracles unfold around us. They light up briefly, like Hanukkah candles. Over the course of the last year, I have sat for long hours among sick human beings, some of whom share the same ailment I suffer from, who keep their heads bent as if their newly acquired baldness is too heavy a weight for them to be able to sit up straight and look up, maybe to a future. For me, a future would mean more understanding and the ability to strike a match and cast a miraculously lasting light on the events in our lives, to line up facts into minute details, including the insufferable misunderstandings of war, racial injustice, poverty, hunger, and incurable illnesses. I'm not a religious person, and what I have learned from reading various writings from different faiths has always only been of cultural interest to me. However, when performing Bach's compositions, I hope I adhered to his Christian faith, whereas improvising music with my Iranian or Indian musician friends led me into Muslim or Buddhist worlds, reaching for a different tonal horizon. I have stood and admired many paintings by the great Italian and Flemish masters that represented their profound belief in religious myth and stories. Amongst them is an etching by Rembrandt called The Star of the Kings, which refers to the biblical story of the 3 kings and 12th night, when 3 kings bearing gifts followed a star which led them to the infant Jesus in Bethlehem. These days, I can often get quite tired, and sometimes, when out for a walk, I need to sit down for a bit to rest. A week or so ago, I couldn't walk any further and had to sit down on a bench in a pedestrian street in Dublin city centre. It was cold, and I noticed that the man sitting beside me was wearing lots of layers over his hoodie. He was smoking a rolled cigarette when he turned to me. His eyes were dark, nearly black. His bearded face looked like a figure from a Caravaggio or a Rembrandt painting. I greeted him with a slightly exhausted, "Hi," and he told me he was Ibrahim from Egypt. He worked as a chef in a nearby pizzeria. He was from Alexandria originally, and we quickly sailed over to Egypt in our chat about the magical library there. We even ended up singing a bit of music by the legendary Egyptian singer Kalsum, who had been one of the first to take me to a different universe outside the European repertoire. Meanwhile, Ibrahim was very kind to me, as concerned about my well-being as if I were his closest friend. He could not return to Egypt at the moment, he said. He had to stay in Dublin, where he was hoping for a miracle to happen. I nodded. That made 2 of us. I kept looking at his biblical appearance, trying to place him into a painting, a time frame, and then I remembered Rembrandt's The Star of the Kings. It was clear to me then that I had met one of them, Ibrahim, the pizza chef, who was smoking away while gifting me with kindness. Now it is Hanukkah, the Jewish holiday of long-lasting light, of gifts, of songs that can be sung in any language or tonality as far as I am concerned, of an everlasting fight against the oppressors of miracles. I had met a king who gave me the gift of kindness. As for a miracle, well, I will hold on to my battered, smuggled menorah.
Ya Habibi, Ya Habibi, Illi no istama, Wangomu, Wamaru.
Gratitude. Grateful for the smell of ground coffee in the morning. For the morning, even if I don't lean towards early rising. For the sun shining brightly in the afternoon. If not this afternoon, then someday soon. Grateful for the wildflowers thriving in their thirst for rain. For the ocean lapping to our sand-crested shores. As the air carries sea salt laden with healing blessings. Grateful for the lines that creep up silently on my face, for the wonder of years galloping past us all, for good times harvesting golden around us, and seeds of regrets falling into ditches. Grateful for star-bright moments blazing suddenly, leaving the sparkle of savoured memories behind, and grateful for the muscle strength of certainties. Grateful for those who paved the path to guide us, for those who chose to prop up what surrounds us, for the unknown future hurtling forwards, and the vision of the past as it turns to ebb away. Grateful for tears that wash away wounds, for words gifted and a welcome, full-hearted smiles, a child's unbridled laugh, a song carried on the breeze, for the taste of joy, warmth of a hug, the grace and love. For hope as it alights in bright wings, I'm grateful.
The Deer of Light, to the memory of St. Gubnet. The angel said my final bed of earth would be revealed by 9 white deer. The sudden shockfall of words, the apparition of such phantom creatures, made me flee before they could appear. From Inishmore I crossed the seas and wandered in strange lands, wherever there was noise, wherever there was colour, to slip my fate. I prayed, listening for God, but only heard my beating heart. And then that Christmas day near Ballyvourney, I almost missed their outlines against the snow. Like unicorns they were, unicorns so pure and innocent. 9 curls of breath. My journey was over, and I kneeled before the Deer of Light, beneath the falling flakes of light.
On this morning's programme, a mix of new and recent archive scripts we heard. Fanny Alexander by Victoria White. Scary Solstice by Sean O'Gorman. Christmas Cheese by Lisa McInerney. Pork Chops, Peas, Chips, Tea, Bread and Butter by Jim Maguire. Hanukkah by the late Judith Mock. Gratitude, a poem by Denise Blake. And The Deer of Light, a poem by James Harper. The music was Once in Royal David City by Cecil Francis Alexander, performed by Vochase 8. Irie na Gréine by Steve Cooney. A Winter's Tale by Mike Batt and Tim Rice, arranged by Thomas Quigley and Kathleen Flynn, and performed by Cormac Kennevy with the RTE Concert Orchestra, conducted by David Brophy. Last Christmas by Wham. Alf Leila wa Leila by the Egyptian singer Kulthum. And John Field's Nocturne No. 5, played by Conor Linehan. A couple of books related to today's programme. A Place Where Ireland is Invisible by James Harper. Sonnets Inspired by Irish Saints with artworks by Paul O'Colmon is published by Iblana Press. And Judith Mock and Jim Maguire's essays can be found in the current anthology from the programme Sunday Miscellany, a selection 2023 to 2025, published by New Ireland. And next Sunday and on Christmas morning, we'll bring you recordings from our latest Christmas Miscellany live show with the RTE Concert Orchestra and special guests, recorded earlier this month at the National Concert Hall. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.